Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the China Geopolitics podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, the Europe correspondent at the South China Morning Post. We're coming at you from Hong Kong, but we're mostly discussing events thousands of miles away this week, in Europe mainly. First up, the G7 foreign ministers got together in London this week with non-G7 members India, Australia, South Korea, ASEAN and South Africa also invited. Top of the agenda was, of course, China. 2 hours of talks focused on Beijing with a hefty dollop of strongly worded statements to follow. There's that, plus China's potential new ambassador to Washington and the resuscitation of US-China trade talks to discuss with political economy editors John Carter and Joe Shin at the top of the show. I'll then speak to a very special guest all the way from Budapest. Tamás Matura is an expert in Hungarian-Chinese relations at the Corvinus University of Budapest. And boy, is that a topic we're keen to get stuck into. Hungary once again blocked the European Union's planned resolutions on Hong Kong. But there's much more to this story than meets the eye. A really good interview, that one. Another bumper episode from a stinking hot Times Square here in Hong Kong. Let's crack on. The week in China geopolitics was dominated by an event at which China was not present. The G7's foreign ministers gathered in London at the start of this week to discuss all things related to the Indo-Pacific. And of course, China was a massive part of this. A massive communique came at the end of the 3-day event in which there were a solid 13 mentions of China. The communique itself was actually massive. There were 6 bullet points on China and it touched really on all the greatest hits, everything from human rights to economic issues to Hong Kong, Xinjiang, to free and fair trade. I'm just glancing through them now. It's nothing really too surprising. John Carter, Joe Shin here to discuss it with me. South China Sea also creeps in there. John, you were saying you had a look through and it was a bit of a gargantuan read.
Right. 12,400 words. 28 pages. It covered everything and in depth. And so, okay, so they've established a baseline. And so now what do they do about it? The communique and the whole foreign minister summit didn't propose any specific action, although afterwards Dominic Raab, the UK foreign minister, did say that they were in the process of developing a rapid response mechanism to disinformation, theoretically aimed at Russia and China. Mm. But beyond that, it was just a lot of words. The G7 called on China to participate constructively in the rule-based international order, implication being that they're not doing so now.
Take that, Beijing.
Yeah, indeed. Now, you have to look at this in the context of overall world global politics. Going back to July last year, there was a UN vote at the Human Rights Council, the UN Human Rights Council, on condemning or not condemning the new national security law for Hong Kong. And it lost. That vote lost. The resolution by 27 nations, including mostly industrialized countries, did not include the U.S. because it's no longer on that panel. But 53 countries supported China opposing statement. A lot of countries from Africa, a lot of developing countries that China supports through the Belt and Road Initiative. And so China has support outside of the G7 framework, and a lot of it because of its efforts in helping developing countries. And so you have to put it in that context, the whole G7 statement and what the next step is and how they're going to proceed with the issues that they outlined in that statement.
Yeah. Joe-shin, this was seen as a, you know, before the event, it was being touted as a way of, announcing the return of the United States to the foreign policy arena, to the multilateral arena, the G7 trying to wrestle back some sort of writing of the rules of the road in the face of, as John mentioned, China's growing influence, particularly among developing nations. How did this event and the communique that followed go down in Beijing? You know, is there an element again of sort of sticks and stones would break my bones, but words will never hurt me?
No, I think this is you've raised a very good question, because this, as John said, you know, this statement is quite strong in wording, but quite economic in terms of actions, specific actions. But mentioning these issues and speaking them loud is also an act, and particularly lots of issues Beijing regarded as, you know, its own sovereignty issue. And this time is basically, for Beijing, it seems like the United States is pulling together all its alliances to form a kind of frontier against China. And this is something really, you know, to be to Beijing's anger and also deep worry. However, I would also like to mention the possible implications of this kind of Western alliance. The one perception is that, you know, once the United States and its allies, the G7 and also Australia, India, and this, like-minded countries are put on the same page against China, the hope is that, you know, China will gradually change its behavior and to be more in line with the hopes of the Western countries. But there's also another very likely scenario is that, you know, after China sees the frontier of the G7, you know, China will, on the contrary, will double down on its chosen strategy and its tactics. You know, there will be even smaller possibilities for any compromises over these mentioned issues. So, and this, of course, will lead to more confrontational engagement between China and the Western world. And so this is not a very positive development for the world, I must say.
Yeah, and Joe-shin, just to pick up on that point, I mean, it seems as though the latter is far more likely. China's, you know, in a position of relative strength. It's emboldened by the COVID-19 outbreak and so on. But it does seem to be doubling down. We saw Xi Jinping tell the party this week that despite all of the swirling headwinds, and to quote the Chinese leader, China is invincible. So there's obviously sort of, do you see that as being a response to the G7 meeting and this sense of maybe that the West and its friends are ganging up on China?
It's not directly at the G7, but certainly, yes, it's targeted at this, as China sees an increasingly hostile environment, that, you know, the United States is leading a coalition trying to contain China's development, despite Washington's insistence that, you know, we are not trying to contain you. We just want you to play by rules. And China will say, "Well, it's not my rules; it's your rules. So why, you know, you are forcing me to do this and that, and, you know, to give up China's sovereignty over Xinjiang or Hong Kong?" So these issues are beyond you know, negotiation. So this is as you mentioned. I think China is doubling down on its chosen strategies. So you can also see from the Australian side, you know, yesterday the National Development and the Planning Commission has severe a kind of dialogue with Australia. And it's, the dialogue has been quiet for a few years, but it sent a very strong signal of Beijing's stance. Say, do not, you know, push me. This is basically the message China is trying to telling Australia. And, you know, Australia, you can't, you know, follow all the way to follow the United States and to contain China, and China will head back. Mm-hmm. This is a message, I think.
Yeah, I think on the Australian one, a couple of conversations I was having with people yesterday saying that the fact that China has exhausted a lot of its weaponry regarding Australia, this forum had been dormant since 2017. It wasn't really seen as that much of a big deal, but it was certainly in response to the cancellation of Belt and Road contracts with Australian states. But John, it shows again, I suppose, as Joe-shin says, that the relationship is getting worse, but this will not be seen perhaps in the same light as maybe the tariffs and duties on Australian goods.
Yes, and a story we're working on at the moment is that the National Development and Reform Commission approves investment projects. So it has a lot of power to block investments where it doesn't want those investments to go, like in Australia. So this may be a warning shot, effectively, because, as you say, this strategic economic dialogue hadn't taken place since 2017. There was no major practical impact of cutting it off, except to formally say, make clear what had already been taking place. We aren't talking to you. And so now we're saying we're definitely not talking to you. Mm-hmm. But the NDRC and the Chinese government have other arrows in their quiver that they can fire at Austria if they want to. Also today, the industry ministry is announcing a plan to cut back on steel production in order, at least the top line argument is, in order to cut pollution emissions. But that also reduces demand for Australian iron ore. And so what does this do? Over the longer run, there are major things that China can still do to crimp Australia. And China is using Australia as an example for the rest of the developed world. We can do this to you. Remember, this is all part of its strategy that the world needs the Chinese domestic market as much, if not more, than China needs the world. And we will see.
We will see, indeed. One thing that we have seen is that the new U.S. Trade Representative, Catherine Tai, gave a couple of interviews this week in which she intimated that there may be talks afoot with China's Vice Premier Liu He, who, of course, was the chief representative during all those rounds of trade talks with Washington, which we covered in depth. John, is this just a sort of formality? You know, I guess they have to talk at some point, or has this been seen as somewhat of an olive branch, or is it just – what's your sense of it?
Potentially an olive branch, but it's more a formality, at least initially. I mean, this would be the first – conversation between Tai since she was nominated and confirmed by the U.S. Senate and Liu He, who is President Xi Jinping's main economic advisor. And as you say, Liu He led the trade negotiations. Liu He was the one who signed the trade agreement back in January of last year. So they're going to talk about progress in the phase one trade deal, and the deal itself calls for meetings every 6 months. The last meeting was in last August, so it's overdue. So this is more procedural than anything substantive. No one expects the U.S. to say, oh, we've seen the light and we're going to reduce the trade tariffs. I mean, Tai herself has said, we're going to keep the tariffs on. Why would I give up the leverage there? Mm-hmm. We need to see more progress. They're going to look for what China is going to tell them about meeting the $200 billion purchase agreement in the trade deal. Mm-hmm. China has met about 60% of that up to now. And so they have a ways to go to catch up. And will they catch up? And what happens next February when the two-year deal ends, does it go on or does it just expire even if China has not met all the purchase requirements? Mm. So these are things they're going to talk about. They're also going to talk about intellectual property protection, which is also in the trade deal. The USTR issued a statement last week saying recognizing progress but not enough progress. So the U.S. is going to push in that direction. What the analysts we've talked to have said, this is all very nice and good, but even if there is progress, quote unquote, on the trade side, it will not do much to improve the overall dynamic of the U.S.-China relationship. Bloomberg had a story overnight that the Biden administration is likely to continue its prohibition on investments in certain Chinese companies related to the military. And under this program that Trump initiated, a number of large Chinese companies, including the three largest telecommunication mm-hmm. companies, have been delisted from U.S. exchanges. And this is likely to continue. And this is not going to be welcomed in Beijing.
Yeah.
It's a sign that Biden is every bit as tough as Trump was on China.
Yeah. Joe-Shane, I'll ask you for your view on the status of trade talks and Catherine Tai, but I also wanted to bring you in to develop it a bit on the Chinese side. We're potentially seeing a new ambassador to the United States. One of the names that has been widely mentioned is Qin Gang. Maybe you could tell us a little bit, first of all, how are the Tai remarks and the potential talks with Liu He? Is this something that, you're hearing on the Chinese side too? And then maybe tell us a little bit about this guy who may be moving to Washington in the near future.
Thank you, Fingba. I think the Tai comments, we have to put that into the context. I mean, in the Trump administration, the trade talk is basically the central piece of the overall China-U.S. relationship. But I think to today, in the Biden administration, the differences are more about the values and ideology, human rights, and it's more in-depth. It's more difficult to solve. So even China agreed to meet, as John just mentioned, as a protocol to meet with trade counterparts in Washington. That really doesn't, has lots of strategic implications. If the trade talks are going to be narrowed down to, as you know, how many tons of soybean China has to buy, then this becomes really like no issue for the overall relationship. For the Chinese government, the priority now apparently, as we just discussed, is more of like how to handle this kind of perceived U.S.-led alliance trying to contain China's rise, and how to. Yesterday, the President Xi Jinping had a phone call with the United Nations guy and say, let's put aside the ideological differences. As for Beijing, it seems quite clear that, the values and the ideology differences have become the centerpiece of the two relations, the relationship between the two countries. So this is a more difficult and more in-depth problem, and it's much harder to solve than, say, trade imbalance issues.
Mm, yeah. And just a quick point on that. Don't forget that the US and China, since Biden has come in, they've already had one meeting in Alaska, and that one didn't go particularly well. So I don't know what that says about future meetings, but worth keeping in mind that this is not the first time that the two countries have gotten together. Joe-Shane, on to the potential for a new ambassador. What can you tell us about this gentleman?
Yes. We had a very good story from our colleague Shi Jiantao, right about the background of this guy. And also, if you put this the appointment of Qin Gang as a likely the new Chinese ambassador in Washington in this context, because China is also, at least for the Chinese top leadership, they also they're seeing there's some big changes in the bilateral relationship. So Qin Gang's appointment, which seems on the surface is kind of break of tradition. By China's diplomatic history. Qin Gang has never been an ambassador. Qin Gang has never worked in his portfolio, he has never managed the bilateral relationship between China and the United States. Mm. So for these two issues, people say he's a black horse. Well, to some extent it is, but also he has like two shining qualifications that will make him the likely ambassador because, A, he's trusted by President Xi. That's without any doubt because he has been in the protocol department, all the receptions and accompanying Xi to all these overseas trips. So he's in Hangzhou in the G20. There's a short video clip showing Xi was basically chit-chatting with Qin Gang about how the work style should be. Mm. So without any doubt, he has the trust of the top leader. This is the most important thing. And then secondly, Qin Gang is not a stranger for most of the foreign media because he is quite a character in his capacity as a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson. In fact, some of the wolf warrior rhetorics or, the stance of hitting back at hard questions started from Qin Gang. So Qin Gang is seeing a person who has the skills and has the capacity, has the courage, or has the knowledge, has the expertise on how to dealing with harsh questions. So this also made him a likely candidate because in the coming years, as I just mentioned, you know, the U.S.-China relationship are likely become more confrontational. So there will be lots of events for the ambassador to, you know, to strongly deliver China's message. Mm-hmm. And so this, in terms of this, I think Qin Gang will be very competitive candidate for this position.
And as a replacement, you're saying that Qin Gang is maybe the architect or at least semi-involved in the origins of this wolf warrior diplomacy. Does this represent a changing of the guard? Like, is this, really formalizing this era of diplomacy in China?
Yes, to some extent, yes, because Cui Tiankai is, widely regarded as like one of the older generation of Chinese diplomats, you know, brought up in the Deng Xiaoping area, in the Brumley, in the Jiang Zemin area. And, you know, his prime time should have been during the Hu Jintao era. And certainly, compared to that time, China's diplomacy has become more, some say, assertive, or in China's own words, is more confident. So I think Qin Gang is more, of course, represent more of the new style of Chinese diplomacy compared to Cui Tiankai.
Yeah. Moving really quickly on to our last topic, I wanted to touch on the news this week about vaccine waivers for intellectual property. Catherine Tai, who we've already talked about, a bit of a bombshell announcement saying that the US would propose or at least back a move to postpone or suspend IP for vaccines in a way, I guess, to roll them out around the world. John, how has this been seen? Does this have legs, and does it have any impact on China, or are they involved?
It has legs in a PR sense, yes. I mean, because it makes America look good. It will help the vaccine get to developing countries faster. But in practical terms, it is just a step in a long process. The vaccine waiver was originally proposed by India and South Africa, who happened to be at the foreign ministers meeting this week, and is supported by more than 100 countries. But now it goes to the World Trade Organization, which has to approve it. And as you can tell it needs to be approved more or less by consensus. And there are still a lot of countries that oppose it. The UK, Canada still, and the EU. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, came out overnight and opposed it, the waiver. And so it's not at all clear that the WTO will approve this waiver. And in practical terms, even if the waiver isn't approved, it just opens up the ability of certain countries to develop their own vaccines without worrying about impinging on others' patents. Mm-hmm. But the ability and the development of vaccines is very complex and takes a lot of time. And a lot of the big pharma companies have said, look, we could have supplied a lot more vaccines to the developing world if not for trade barriers that already exist. The waiver isn't the problem. The problem is getting production to the places where it's needed. Mm. So, yes, the waiver is a step in the right direction, but it's only one step, and it remains clear if it will be sufficient to get the ball rolling faster.
Yeah. Is there any chatter about it in China, Jushin? Has there been any comment, or generally not on the radar?
I'm not paying particular attention to that, but the only thing I realize is that all the vaccine-related stocks has plunged yesterday.
Okay, that's one barometer of how the news is being greeted anyway.
It's not good for vaccine stock prices, although when Merkel opposed it, the vaccine stock prices popped up.
Indices are back up this morning. Yeah. Great stuff. Guys, that's been really interesting. John Carter, Jushin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As critical news stories emerging from China continue to shape lives and business around the world, the weekly SCMP Global Impact Newsletter brings you expert analyses and insights on the economics of COVID-19, society, technology, and the environment. Sign up to receive your weekly email at scmp.com/newsletters.
It's been a busy week for EU-China relations, and Hungary has been right at the centre of it all. I'm joined on the line by Tamás Matura, who is a China expert at the Corvinus University of Budapest, to talk about Hungary's role in all these events. Tamás, we saw this week again for the second month in a row, the Hungarian government in the representation in Brussels blocking EU's conclusions on Hong Kong. Now, these are conclusions which were supposed to be adopted at the Foreign Affairs Council, which would have seen the EU criticise Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong, the national security law, the electoral reform. It would have seen some measures introduced around EU member states' extradition treaties with mainland China, around the freedom for Hong Kong people to move and work in Europe. Nothing too biting, but nonetheless, conclusions that the EU hoped to pass. What is behind Budapest's continual obstinance here, Tamás? Why are they blocking the EU's efforts to do something on Hong Kong?
Okay, I think to understand Hungary's foreign policy and China policy, first of all, we have to understand the bigger picture, and that is the so-called peacock's dance. The Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, mentioned it several times that his foreign policy can be compared to a peacock's dance. What does it mean in reality? It means that this is not only about China. This is about Russia, Turkey, the United States, the EU, and Germany in particular. And this is an opportunistic foreign policy followed by the prime minister. It technically means that he always tries to please every major player in the Central and Eastern European region. So he takes one step to the right, one step to the back, and tries to rattle his beautiful feathers to please everyone, including Russia, Turkey, and all of these major countries. I know it sounds funny, but actually it is the prime minister himself who described his foreign policy strategy, or I would rather say it's a tactics as a peacock's dance. So whatever he does about China, it is in the context of this wider picture or bigger picture. So when it comes to China itself, I think we have to pay attention to some very important details. And that is, in the past decade, the Hungarian government has offered a lot of gestures and symbolic, gifts, if I may say so, to the Chinese. But there is a very important detail over here, that whatever the Hungarian government has presented to China as a gift has always been political by nature, including Hong Kong issue, including the South China Sea issue, when the Hungarian government kind of supported the Chinese understanding, when it comes to blocking joint EU statement, when it comes to not criticizing the Belt and Road Initiative like many other European countries did, or all other European countries did. So it means that all of these gifts are political by nature. And meanwhile, when it comes to issues where economic considerations are at stake, especially economic considerations important to Germany, in those cases, the Hungarian government always sticks to the European stance or the German understanding of that particular issue. So this is a double game, if I may say so. On the one hand, pleasing the Chinese when it comes to these political clashes between the West and China, and at the very same time, sticking to German economic and industrial interest, because in reality, the Hungarian government is not dependent on China. It is heavily dependent on Germany. Mm-hmm. But given the past decades, international circumstances, it seems that this kind of opportunistic foreign policy, this kind of tactics, may pay off in the short and medium term. I'm not sure about the long term, because the world is heading towards an international environment where sooner or later a country may have to choose whether it sticks to Western values or not.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, obviously being out here in Hong Kong covering Chinese affairs, we talk a lot about Hungary in the context of China, and perhaps it's lost in the wider coverage that Berlin is more important than Beijing. If Berlin was harder line on China, obviously great trade relations, huge investment, and huge commercial ties between Germany and China, but the German leadership is obviously more reluctant than other parts of Europe to be very critical of China. Do you think if that situation was to change, we've got a German election this year, then we may see this peacock dance have to take a new direction?
Absolutely, but a lot depends on what kind of direction Germany may choose following its elections, because now a lot of people expect that any kind of new German government, especially one with a strong presence of the Green Party, may change the attitude of Angela Merkel's Germany towards a new direction and a more confrontative direction when it comes to China. However, I'm a little bit, you know, doubtful, because we know that we have this experience that whenever a party is in opposition, it is easy to be critical. It is easy to promise, you know, confrontative measures. However, when you get into the government, then you have to face the reality. You have to face that China is super important. And in a matter of days, important German industrial interest groups will knock on your door and will tell you that, hey, yeah, we do understand the importance of human rights and all these value-based issues, but we still want to keep selling our cars and other stuff in China. So please be considerate about dealing with China. So frankly speaking, I do not expect a huge turnaround in German foreign policy vis-a-vis China. So in that regard, what may trigger a change in Budapest foreign policy is either the Hungarian elections next year, 2022, May 2022. And even though it is highly probable the current government can keep its seat, but that is also sure that in 12 years, this is the first time when a defeat is on the table, so we cannot exclude that. And a new Hungarian government would definitely follow a very different China policy, because I think that's an important detail, that the Hungarian pro-China policy is a personal policy of the prime minister and some important people in the governing party. There is no public support in Hungary behind that. There is no media support behind that. And even economic considerations do not really play into this whole game, because the real economic importance of China to the Hungarian economy is not that high. So in case of an opposition party or parties or coalition comes into the picture next year, I expect a major change in the Hungarian foreign policy, generally speaking, and in particular towards China. And the other major factor that may play into this game is, of course, the Biden administration. Last year, I had the pleasure to attend the conference where Central European and very high-profile American-China experts exchanged some views. And an American colleague over there explicitly mentioned Hungary as a country what may feel the increase of pressure coming from Washington, because, as they phrased it, the Biden administration, which intends to forge a global alliance of like-minded nations and democracies, can it afford itself to have a country with democratic backsliding within its own inner circle, a NATO and EU member state? So I think this process may have already started in the background behind the curtains. There have been some gossips that a few months ago, Foreign Secretary Blinken and the Hungarian Foreign Secretary, Mr. Szijjártó, had a conversation at a major international event. And over there, Mr. Blinken sent a very strong message to the Hungarian side that America can live with strong Hungarian-Chinese economic relations. They don't think that it has to cause any concern, but the strong political relationship between Budapest and Beijing, this is something America cannot really stand. Mm-hmm. And in the past few weeks, we have seen some other important and strong signals coming from Washington to Budapest. So far, it seems that the Hungarian government is either ignorant or reluctant to react positively to these messages. Last week, the Chinese ambassador in Budapest had the opportunity to publish two op-eds in two major Hungarian governmental mouthpieces, and the next day, Viktor Orban announced his intention to travel to Beijing soon. So far, it seems that this peacock dance is still going on, at least till next May.
Yeah, indeed. Can I ask you just another sort of detail on the Hungary's policy, or Hungary's position as one of the EU's 27 member states? It's interesting that in March, the European Union issued its first sanctions on China since Tiananmen Square in 1989. These were sanctions on some relatively mid-rank officials over the alleged human rights abuses in Xinjiang. Of course, these, in the same way as the resolutions on Hong Kong, they have to have the support of all the member states. The day that the sanctions were announced, the Hungarian foreign minister was calling them a waste of time and calling them pointless. But clearly, Hungary had signed up for this. And I'm wondering, how can we read this dynamic where 1 month Hungary is signing up for the sanctions on China, the next month it's blocking the resolutions on Hong Kong? Is this basically, can we read into this that maybe Germany wasn't exerting too much pressure on Hungary re-Hong Kong, but perhaps regarding sanctions they had to come into line? Or was it because the United States was involved? Where do you explain that? How do you explain that discrepancy?
Well, I can only speculate, of course, because I'm not a member of the Hungarian government, obviously. But I would speculate that maybe when it came to the sanctions, it wasn't the EU itself alone, but maybe even the United States of America expressed its, well, strong desires to that all countries of the EU should get in line and should get on board. I think it pretty much fits into this peacock's dance model that, you know, one step ahead or one step back, two steps ahead. So this kind of dance. And that was the moment when Hungary had to take the right direction. And of course, it tried to make its decision to support the sanctions a little bit less sharp by criticizing it right after it. So in a matter of minutes, it's not, you know, the most elegant thing to do, I believe, at least in according to diplomatic standards. Well, actually, it resonated pretty well in Beijing. And in the subsequent days, I remember that the Chinese published a lot of news and articles and commentaries in which they did explicitly mention Hungary as, you know, one of the last countries what really understands how important China is and the true friend of China, the Hungarian government, etc., etc. Furthermore, we have seen certain occasions in the past few years when the block or the veto of one single member state was, of course, embarrassing to the EU, but the EU also found a way to circumvent it. And for example, they announced certain condemnation of China, saying that the following 27 or 26 member states of the EU all agreed upon it. And of course, they did not mention that Hungary was not on board. Mm-hmm. So the EU can still send a very strong message. And if the US also put some pressure on Hungary, maybe that was the reason Hungary also signed up to a certain extent to the sanctions. And now it seems that the Hungarian government believes it's due time to take a step back, not supporting further comments on Hong Kong.
Yeah, yeah. Can I ask you about the view of the EU-China investment deal in Hungary? I suppose the Hungarian government's fairly supportive of this. It looks like it's dead in the water in terms of getting ratified by the European Parliament. The sanctions certainly didn't help. We had a bit of a confusing situation earlier this week with the EU Trade Commissioner. He gave an interview to the AFP, which wasn't necessarily very clear what he was saying, and the AFP perhaps didn't use the best headline. But regardless, it seems to be a bit of a confusing situation. But generally, how is it viewed in Hungary differently to the rest of Europe? Do you think that there's support for it? Do you think that the deal is dead?
I believe for most of the Central and Eastern European countries, the investment deal wasn't, you know, really high on the agenda, because the Central European countries like Hungary, we are part of the global supply chain, and the way we are attached to the global supply chain is through Germany. That's probably one of the reasons Hungary always follows the German lead when it comes to economic questions and economic matters. So indeed, the Hungarian government and most of the Central European countries, as far as I remember, did support the treaty or the agreement to be signed with the Chinese. Now it's a major question how to proceed with the ratification of The agreement, I believe that many members of the European Parliament, delegated by Hungarian opposition parties, now will not support the signature of the agreement, especially because, and that was a major surprise even to me, in the past year, in Hungary, China has finally become a major political topic. In the past 10 years, actually, China wasn't really important as a topic in Hungary because most of the, actually all the major parliamentary parties technically supported strong relationship to China because the very strong relationship between the two sides wasn't initiated by the current government. It started back in 2003 when the socialist prime minister of the time visited Beijing, and the socialist and left-wing parties started this whole procedure to start a kind of rapprochement towards China. And it is only in the past 6 months or maximum 1 year when the Chinese topic became a major topic in Hungary. And ironically speaking, this is partially because of the mistakes the Chinese side committed. For example, they sent some quite harsh letters to opposition members of the Hungarian parliament, what actually provided a very good opportunity to these opposition people to, you know, whip up a little bit this topic. And because of the Belgrade-Budapest railway line, because of the potential arrival of Fudan University to Budapest, and all of these somewhat shady issues turned the topic of China into a major political debate in Hungary.
Tamás Matura, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for listening to this week's China Geopolitics podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham at the South China Morning Post. It's been a really busy week. The news cycle is relentless, but we're trying our best to keep pace with it. We'll be back next week with more of the same. Tune in then and stay safe.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.